Shalom, I'm Rabbi Stephen Sachs, answering the unanswerable. Rosh Hashanah Day 1, 5779. Renowned biblical scholar Dr. Bart Ehrman recently spoke about his new book, The Triumph of Christianity, with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. The book sounds fascinating, I'd love to read it, but it was something else that Ehrman said that really got my attention. Ehrman explained he used to be from, observant, that is, an observant, born-again, evangelical Christian. Okay, he didn't actually use the word from, but you get the point. And though Ehrman at one point even served as a Baptist pastor, he now considers himself to be agnostic, a person who claims neither faith nor disbelief in God. In fact, Ehrman explained that if somebody says to me, "Is there a greater power in the universe?" my response is, "How would I know?" So Bart, I have to ask you, what happened? Why? Why did you lose your faith? Ehrman explains that his doubt has nothing to do with his scholarship. His doubt is caused by an issue we all should be struggling with, the Odyssey. The Odyssey raises the question of how an all-powerful God who is good can allow for so much suffering. While Ehrman's view should be accorded the utmost respect, I don't think you came to shul today to hear your rabbi champion agnostic worldview. It'd be foolish on my part, I'd be talking myself out of a job. But in all seriousness, Judaism engages in an act of theological jujitsu, reversing the question of theodicy in the midrashic tale of the Birah Doleket, the burning palace. Avraham, or Abraham, encounters a palace ablaze, the palace symbolizes the world, and wonders why the owner is not trying to rescue his palace from the flames. The owner, God, says to Avraham in essence, "Stop looking at me, Avraham, it's your world too. You go fix it, you put out the flames." Dr. Martin Luther King understood this lesson. In his famous letter from a Birmingham jail, he responded to fellow clergy members who believed that it was posnish, inappropriate, or as they put it, unwise for a clergy member to be politically active and create a public stir as King was doing. In other words, they believed religion was to be confined to the chapel and kept off the street. If King had acquiesced to the request, he would have been inadvertently giving credence to Karl Marx's dismissal of religion as the opiate of the masses. That is, religion is a tool used to distract the downtrodden from their misery by busying them with ritual and the false hope of a better life in the afterlife. King refused to acquiesce, explaining that he was walking in the footsteps of the prophets of the 8th century, figures such as Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah, who refused to allow justice to be perverted for the sake of maintaining a social order. King, Israel's prophets of old, and all who fight injustice and work to improve the world are the spiritual descendants of Abraham. Before leaving the Midrash, let us also know that indirectly this Midrash reminds us that we shouldn't expect Judaism to provide us with all the answers. The question of why God allows the world to be set ablaze in the first place is totally sidestepped. When the pious E over Job demands to know why God had allowed him to suffer, God's response was in essence, there are some things which are simply beyond human comprehension. Despite the fact that this was not the answer that Eov was looking for, he remained a loyal servant of God. Furthermore, even though Eov felt that he had been horribly mistreated, he came to the realization that there was still a value in serving God. And who could argue with that? Even if we unjustly suffer, is there any downside to performing ma'asim tovim, good deeds? Now you can counter by claiming you don't need organized religion or you don't even have to believe in God in order to do good works. Fair enough. But first consider the research of Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam. Putnam in his work, Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, lamented America's loss of social capital, which he defines as social networks through which people help one another. But years later, after extensive research, Putnam found a silver lining. Storehouses of social capital still exist today in houses of worship. Research demonstrates that people who attend religious services regularly are more likely to not only give to religious charities, but to secular ones as well. They're also more likely to volunteer their time to charitable causes and spend time with somebody who's depressed. Most eye-opening was the finding that these generous behaviors don't correlate to an individual's religious beliefs, but to the frequency with which they attend services. Putnam even speculated that an atheist who attended services regularly, perhaps because he was accompanying a spouse, would be more charitable than somebody who prayed at home. Why does attendance at religious services inspire this generous behavior? Let's look at it this way. When we pray, we often make requests that God improve the world. The middle section of our weekday Amidah is comprised of bakashot, requests we make of God. Over Vijamim Naraim, these days of awe, we'll make request after request of God. But if life has taught us anything, it's taught us that often it's not enough to make a request. We have to do our part to bring the desired results to fruition. It's not enough to ask God to help others. We have to roll up our sleeves and do our part. Muhammad Ali once said that performing good deeds was his rent payment for the space he had been granted in this world. By attending services regularly, we surround ourselves with people who believe it's their God-given responsibility to perform Ma'asim Tovim, acts of goodness. That sense of mission is contagious. Instead of focusing on the unanswerable question of theodicy, we can channel our energy in ways that can tangibly improve the world. You can also personally benefit from attending services. A survey in Great Britain reported that the average Facebook user has over 200 friends on Facebook. When asked how many of those friends the user could actually count on to help him or her out of a jam, the average answer was 2. The friends you make at services aren't your casual social media friends. They're the people you can count on when the chips are down. You'll be there for them, and they'll be there for you. I'm now going to conclude with a story which demonstrates the degree to which God has put his trust in us. This Talmudic story, referred to as the Tanur Shel Achnai, the oven of a man named Achnai, narrates a debate over a question of ritual purity regarding Achnai's oven. Rabbi Eliezer took a lenient view regarding the ritual purity of the oven, while the Chachamim, the sages, his colleagues, took a stricter view. Though Rabbi Eliezer was in the minority, he wasn't deterred. He declared that if the law was in accordance with me, let this carob tree prove it. The carob tree was uprooted from its place and moved 100 amot. The Chachamim, the sages, weren't impressed, responding that one cannot bring forth proof from a carob tree. Rabbi Eliezer, still undeterred, declared that if the law is in accordance with me, let the water of the canal prove it. The canal's waters flowed backwards, but still, the Chachamim were not convinced. Rabbi Eliezer decided to give it yet another go and declared that if the halacha is in accordance with me, let the walls of the Bet Midrash, the study hall, prove it. The walls of the Bet Midrash began to lean downwards as if to fall, but Rabbi Yehoshua, one of the opposing sages of the majority, rebuked the walls, reminding them that they should not intervene in this machloket, in this argument. It wasn't their place. Finally, Rabbi Eliezer pulled out his ace in the hole and declared that if the halacha is in accordance with me, let a bat kol, a heavenly voice, prove it. A bat kol rang out proclaiming, what argument do you have with Rabbi Eliezer who the halacha follows in all places? It appeared that if Rabbi Eliezer had won, after all, who can argue with a heavenly proclamation? The Chachamim, the sages, responded with a verse from Devarim, Deuteronomy. Lo bashamayim hei, the Torah is not in heaven. That's to say that God transmitted the Torah to us, and it is our job to apply its teachings to this world. In other words, even though God agreed with Rabbi Eliezer's ruling, the Chachamim wouldn't accept it. Rabbi Natan then met Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, and asked him how God had taken being overruled by the Chachamim, by the sages. Eliyahu responded that God had laughed, saying, Nitzchuni benai, Nitzchuni benai. My children have prevailed over me, my children have prevailed over me. Though this story revolves around a technical point of law, its implications are far-reaching. The broader message is that God has empowered us to take charge of His world. Instead of waiting passively for Him to fix it, we should start the job of Tikkun Olam, of repairing the world. So this year, let's try to spend less time asking why, that is, why does injustice take place, and more time asking what, that is, what can we do about it? Judaism doesn't always provide us with all the answers, but it teaches us how to live with the unanswerable.